History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there, down the street, around the corner, maybe even right next door. And you know, I tell you that every week, but sometimes I need to be reminded of that truth as well, and this week's episode is certainly a testament to that. Our goal, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, it's incredible the perspective we can pick up. It's amazing how much we can learn. We're educated, yes, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. On today's program, you're going to hear from a humble hero who finished his time as a Navy fighter pilot just one aerial victory shy of being an ace. If any one of his unconfirmed kills had been confirmed, he would have carried that title. But Chuck Houston isn't just a decorated fighter pilot. He's an accomplished sculptor, first-class woodworker, and also the author and compiler of one of the most impressive and thorough books I've seen produced by World War II veterans, and I've read quite a few. And this is one that has really raised my eyebrows this week, because after interviewing veterans for 15 years, I certainly didn't think there would be a story like this right under my nose. A gentleman who for 15 years I lived just a few blocks away from, with not only an incredible life, but a connection to the college football program I'm privileged to announce the games for, and this remarkable book. If you've ever browsed around on hometownheroesradio.com, you know there's a library tab, links to books written by or about the veterans who've shared their stories on this program. Some of them are New York Times bestsellers on that list, but I don't think any of those books have ever floored me like this one. It's called Flying with Iron Angels, The Diaries and Memories of Navy Carrier Pilots Fighting the Pacific War in 1944. I hope you'll take a look at it, and I have to thank one of our listeners, Chris Cochran of Sacramento, California, for letting me know about the book and the remarkable man who wrote it. Chuck Houston is 96 years old now, and he'll be the first to tell you that while some memories have endured, others have gone a little fuzzy. But this book he wrote, his labor of love, will give us some touch points throughout the interview today. We'll talk about some of his closest calls, as well as the loss of so many friends, including one of his college football teammates at Fresno State. Let's start out in the early years, though. You grew up here in Fresno with a sister. How early did you get interested in aviation? Did you have some of those aviation heroes like Lindbergh or Doolittle and those guys?
Oh, yes, since way back. All those old-timers were my big heroes. From the time I was a little kid.
You were reading about them in the newspaper or what?
Oh, in a newspaper. It was a lot of exposure all the time.
Is that something you always dreamed of doing yourself, flying?
Oh, yes. That was my big ambition when I was a little kid, to get in a plane and fly.
Did you have any idea that war was imminent, that there could be a war that America got caught up in?
Oh, yes, we could all feel it coming on. It was all in the papers and on the radio. It was all building up.
So you're hearing about what Hitler is doing in Europe and what the Japanese are doing in the Pacific. And did you have any Japanese-American friends or classmates?
Oh, yes, I had quite a few. They were good friends, and of course, they were in a tough position, but they were good friends.
And do you remember anything about that day, December 7th? Do you remember hearing that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, only vaguely. I do remember being glued to the radio, but I don't remember any details about it.
And I've had a lot of people tell me how things changed after that. Certainly for your Japanese-American friends, it changed. They were rounded up and sent to camps and held behind barbed wire. For you, was there an immediate desire to get involved somehow, to join the service, or did you wait a little while?
Right away, we were ready to go.
Well, in your book, Flying with Iron Angels, you say, Gene Streeter and I joined the Navy together in June 1942. Five of us friends from Fresno went up to San Francisco together to sign up for flight training. Gene Streeter, Robert Clancy, Robert Garner, and Donald Gray, all of us recent students at Fresno State College. What made you believe that you could be a pilot? because a lot of guys tried, but not all that many succeeded. What was it that gave you the confidence to try?
Oh, I knew I could be a pilot. It was just automatic. I just knew without any doubt that I would be a pilot. As I remember, a few were killed along the way. It was a case of various guys getting killed at various times in different ways all the way along. There was a lot of excitement mixed in with it.
And you write about a lot of that in this book. But I'm wondering if you can think back to that young man, that teenager, signing up out of Fresno State to go be a pilot. Did the inherent danger weigh on you at all? Did you think there was a chance that you might not come back?
I suppose there may have been a little thought back there, but I didn't pay much attention to it. I was interested in flying, and I knew I would be the victorious one.
Well, and you have 4 confirmed aerial victories to your credit, one shy of being an ace. Some of those unconfirmed, if they got confirmed, would make you an ace. What about the decision, though, to fly for the Navy as opposed to the Army? You could have gone in the Army Air Corps. What was it about the Navy that attracted you?
Probably the fact that they weren't here. The Army was right here, so they were too familiar. The Navy was out there and was out on the ocean and was more exciting and distant and adventurous.
Well, I guess that's a point. So you grew up in Fresno, and Hammer Field was being constructed and then operated at that time. And this idea of carrier flying was brand new. Now we're all used to it, and we watch the jets take off. But this had as a kid, you never heard about this. This was something, you were a pioneer, weren't you?
That was all new stuff, yeah. New adventures.
Did you have in your mind an idea of which particular Navy aircraft you thought you would like to fly?
Fighter planes, always. That's what I wanted. The Hellcat.
What was it like to fly the Hellcat? Because there aren't too many guys around anymore who actually flew a Hellcat. What was that plane like to fly?
It was a real thrill. It had power. It could just do all kinds of exciting maneuvers. Just a wonderful airplane. It was just a great plane, and I just fell in love with it. Just loved to fly it.
I'll get into some of the specifics, and what I'd love to do is read some of your magnificent book here and have you comment on some of the things you wrote. But maybe let's cover a little bit just generally speaking here. So if you look at the totality of your missions, and I mentioned the 4 aerial victories, and we know if you shot 4 enemy planes down, you came close to being shot down plenty yourself just by the nature of aerial combat. But if you had to go through, for someone who's completely unfamiliar with this idea, the different hazards you were facing, the different things that could have ended your life if it didn't go your way, how many different factors did you have to take into consideration and watch out for?
They were endless. Things are happening from every direction all the time. You had to have your head on a swivel, watching in every direction, because you never knew what was coming in on you.
And it could come in from a ship down below, from a plane up above, from a plane right in front of you?
Any direction. We were a great target up there.
And what about the weather?
Well, of course, weather was always a great factor because we were in and out of clouds all the time and rain squalls. Weather was a very important factor, and especially when it came to being able to land back on the carrier. It was nice to be able to see the deck.
And generally speaking, how would your missions unfold? Are you flying in formation? What was the typical MO?
Typical 4-plane division. Of course, then we would also group various divisions together. Could sometimes have 12, 16. But basically, we started off as 2 planes and then 4 planes in a division. We had a section of 2 and then 4. And then we would gather divisions together, and we could have many, many dozens of us in a flight. Of course, we were always above and out to the side of the bombers, protecting them from many Japanese planes.
And what about the armament aboard your Hellcat? What all did you have at your disposal?
Well, we had 6 big machine guns in our wings. We had our machine guns up in the cowling or at the engine. And, of course, we had armor plate around us, behind us, and under us, so that planes coming in from different angles might shoot at us, but we had heavy steel plates that protected us. It seemed pretty fast, but actually not very fast. We really weren't that fast an airplane, but course, when you're in a plane, it can seem awfully fast.
And you have to make decisions really fast. Well, I want to go through and pick some sections out of your book and read it to you and ask you about it. See what kind of memories it evokes for you. As each of us rolled into our dives from 10,000 feet, our fighters led the way, strafing the guns firing up at us from the ships below. Behind the first fighters in a long string of diving planes, I was out to the left side of a dive bomber with my trigger finger putting out six lines of tracer bullets at the ship below in my gun sight. So let me pause in that narrative there and ask you, what does that feel like when you start your dive and you're going down, down, down with guns a-blazing and the other stuff is flying back up at you? Most of us will never experience that in our lives. So can you help us understand what those few seconds feel like in the cockpit?
It's pretty hard to put it into words because there's so much emotion involved. The excitement of shooting at someone and, of course, the excitement of being shot at. It's hard to put into words.
I think a lot of people would be closing their eyes and clenching every muscle in their body. How about you?
No, you're busy. All of your muscles are very busy, pushing your feet on the rudder pedals and your hands on the stick and your other left hand on the throttle. Your feet and your hands are very busy.
And how do you know when to pull up?
You see what's happening. You see the water coming up at you. You know you've got to pull up. All those things just going to happen automatically.
Well, let's continue with your story here as you so adeptly wrote. Suddenly, we were halfway down to the water. A stream of tracer bullets came from my right side, passing between me and the SB-2C, and then a Tony flew between us, crossing close in front of me and almost into my stream of bullets. I kept my trigger finger pressed down while pulling back on the stick to raise my fire just a little bit higher, and the Tony would pass right through my bullets, I hoped. Unfortunately, by that time, I had continued firing my guns too long without a pause, and I was going to find out soon that I had burned out all six gun barrels. I pulled after the Tony, and as he came out of his dive, I was behind him along with another F-6F. As we reached the edge of Manila Bay at Bataan Peninsula, I had gained on the Tony enough to shoot again, but just as I fired, he pulled into a very tight turn at the perfect time to give me a hard deflection shot. It was then that I saw my line of bullets corkscrewing and tumbling wildly, and I knew my guns were gone.
That's right. The barrels are melted, curved, and curled up, and they're just tumbling out of the barrels. They're not doing any good anymore.
So, you continue. The story isn't done. Right then, I should have given up the whole thing and gone back to protect our bombers. But I was so mad at this guy for busting through our formation, I wasn't thinking clearly and was just determined to get him. The Tony pulled another very tight turn into me and broke loose enough to come back at me head on. His four guns were flashing at me, while my six guns were putting out the tumbling lines of corkscrewing bullets going harmlessly toward him. Maybe they looked dangerous to him, but I knew better. Again, I'm thinking about what that felt like for you. You got a plane flying straight at you, and his guns work fine, and all his bullets are heading at your plane, and you're pretty much defenseless. That's got to be a horrible feeling.
Yes, it's a very, very unsettling feeling, but it only happens for a short instant. It doesn't go on very long.
All right, well, that story wasn't done, so I'm going to keep reading. Again, these are all your words. We passed each other nearly head-on with about 20 feet between our two right wingtips, and as I looked across, I could see the helmeted face in his cockpit looking back at me. This is the only time during the war that I actually saw the face of the human I was fighting rather than just an airplane. That sounds like that made an impression on you.
Yes, it made an impression. It's still there. The image is still there, yeah. I don't think it changed anything. They were our targets, and we were out there to shoot them down.
Well, you continue. I must confess at this point that what I did that afternoon was not very smart, and also I ignored the flight tactics and doctrine that had been so thoroughly drilled into us. Fighter pilots were not supposed to go chasing off alone on personal missions. The fighter pilot's primary job and responsibility was to protect our bombers, and I had been wrong to let myself be sucked out of position and away from our group of planes. Also, it was just dumb luck that saved me from another Japanese plane picking me off while I was concentrating on that one Tony.
It took a little while for it all sink in and for me to gradually wise up and become a little smarter pilot.
And I know that was not your only close call. We could probably sit here all day talking about the things that could have killed you in World War II. So was it all just luck that you came back here to Fresno to raise four kids, to create all these sculptures and woodworking? Or as you contemplate, as you took all the time to write this book, do you feel that someone was pulling some strings or someone was protecting you? How do you really feel about it?
Well, naturally, I felt I was the world's greatest fighter pilot. That's taken for granted. But I knew that there was an awful lot of luck, that someone was riding along with me and protecting me. I was a very lucky pilot.
And what a privilege to have this pilot with us today. Check out the photos of Chuck Houston then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also find a link to his book, Flying with Iron Angels. And there's much more to come, from miraculously surviving a crash in training to his four confirmed aerial victories and even some of the unconfirmed. Our conversation with this decorated World War II Navy fighter pilot continues right after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.